This is Dan Rodericks. I'm recording this podcast at the Kennedy Farm, about 4 miles from the Potomac River in Washington County. This is a part of Maryland that's still pretty rural. And out here today, we're going to be meeting with Gene Meyer, former reporter and editor of the Washington Post and author of a book about the five African-American men who joined John Brown's army for the raid on Harper's Ferry in October 1859.
Roughly Speaking with Dan Rodericks is brought to you by the Ivy Bookshop, an independent bookstore at Falls Road and Lake Avenue in Baltimore. The Ivy stocks a wide selection of books covering Baltimore and the Chesapeake Bay region, many by local authors. Located at 6080 Falls Road, more information can be found at theivybookshop.com or by calling 410-377-2966.
This is Roughly Speaking, episode 423. John Brown was a fierce abolitionist who so hated slavery that he took up arms against slaveholders, killed some of them, and hoped to inspire a rebellion of slaves. His travels took him through his native New England to New York, Pennsylvania, and the Midwest. He knew Frederick Douglass. He knew Harriet Tubman. He helped fugitive slaves reach Canada. And in 1858, at Chatham, Ontario, he convened a meeting to approve a constitution for a government of liberated slaves that he hoped to establish in the Appalachian Mountains. In 1859, Brown, under the name of Isaac Smith, rented the farmhouse that sits here off Chestnut Grove Road. And this is where he and his small army prepared to attack and commandeer the federal arsenal at Harper's Ferry across the Potomac River in what is now West Virginia, still Virginia back then. Among Brown's band of raiders were five African-American men who have been generally overlooked in historical accounts of the raid on Harper's Ferry: John Copeland, Shields Green, Dangerfield Newby, Lewis Leary, and Osborne Perry Anderson. Their stories are now told in a new book by longtime journalist Eugene Meyer, a former reporter and editor for the Washington Post. Five for Freedom is the name of Gene Meyer's book. It tells the story of the escaped slave and the freeborn and freed men who joined John Brown here on the Kennedy Farm in the late summer of 1859. My GPS says we're in Sharpsburg. We're not in Sharpsburg.
No.
Gene Meyer, where are we?
That might be the postal address, but that's not the location.
Do we know what town this is?
There's no town. This was the place where John Brown and his associates gathered and prepared for their attack on Harper's Ferry.
From reading your book, I have a new appreciation for John Brown, how well organized he was, how most of the time he was pretty well funded, and how much he traveled. And how much he did, how much he got away with.
Well, he did. He had a farm in the Adirondacks at North Elba in Essex County, New York. Didn't spend that much time there. He was in Chatham, Ontario. That's where he had a constitutional convention to adopt a provisional constitution for the free republic he hoped to establish in the Appalachian Mountains of Virginia. And, of course, he was planning to do the raid earlier, but then word got out and some of his financial backers got cold feet. And so he went out to Kansas, well, first Missouri, to sort of reestablish his bona fides. And he was able to liberate 11 slaves, and he took them ultimately to Detroit and then into Canada. And also he was in Kansas during what was known as Bleeding Kansas in the 1858 period, when they were fighting over whether Kansas would be a free or slave state. And he was very active there. He really made a reputation. And he and some of his sons and others engaged in what was known as the Pottawatomie Massacre, in which five slave-owning families were murdered. And this made him notorious in many circles. So his reputation preceded him wherever he went after that.
And that helped him raise more money again, right?
Well, he had financial backers from New England. They were known as the Secret Six. And they were well-to-do, aristocratic gentlemen. So after he had sort of reestablished his reputation, they came through with funds which enabled him to purchase 200 Sharps rifles and 1,000 pikes and other arms with which he would mount his attack on Harper's Ferry.
He had the implements of war that you just described shipped to this farm, right?
Well, they were first shipped to Chambersburg. That was sort of the middle ground. Mm-hmm. And he referred to them there as tools. And he actually had a storage facility there. And several of the men who eventually found their way to this farm, including the five that I write about, lived in Chambersburg for a time. Then ultimately the weapons were moved from Chambersburg about 50 miles south to this location where we are right now. There were many abolitionists who were in the abstract or against slavery, but they harbored stereotypical views of black people. And John Brown did not. And John Brown saw people as people. And that was evident in the way he treated these five during the time that they were together. And throughout his life, as far as I could tell. So that made him kind of unique even in during that period.
How many men, including your five, assembled in this farmhouse before the raid on Harper's Ferry?
I think there were a total of 22, but only 19, including Brown, actually went to the ferry.
And looking at that house, Gene, it's kind of hard to imagine 22 men actually hiding out there during the day because they were ordered to stay in the loft of the house and not be seen during the day.
You know, they did stay indoors during the day. In the evenings, as Osborne Anderson, one of the five, later wrote, they would go out for a ramble and enjoy the starry skies of Washington County, Maryland. They stayed there and tried not to arouse suspicion. John Brown's daughter, Annie Brown, and his daughter-in-law were there to do the cooking and the cleaning and hang out the wash and try to make it look like there was nothing out of the ordinary.
So there was no suspicion ahead of time that John Brown was here. He came in under a different name.
He came in under the name of Isaac Smith, and he rented this property for $75 for 9 months, $75 in gold, and that would have been an $1,859, so that probably would be the equivalent of several hundred dollars, maybe $1,000 today.
How long were John Brown and his men in this farmhouse before the raid? About how long?
He rented the farmhouse. It was around July, so it was October 16th that they left here on a rainy, damp night and marched 4 miles down to the Potomac and another mile over to the bridge to Harper's Ferry.
There were thousands of rifles in the armory at Harper's Ferry. Brown hoped to seize them and get them into the hands of slaves. But while the raid started well, it did not end that way. Brown's small army was surrounded and trapped under attack by locals until federal troops arrived under the command of Colonel Robert E. Lee. Brown refused to surrender. When the barricade and gun battles ended on October 18th, Brown's men had killed four people and wounded nine. 10 of Brown's men were killed, including two of his sons. Five escaped, and seven were captured along with Brown. Two of the African-American men, Lewis Leary and Dangerfield Newby, were killed, and two later went to the gallows, John Anthony Copeland and Shields Green. Osborne Perry Anderson managed to escape. As a reporter for the Washington Post, Gene Meyer came across the story of Osborne Perry Anderson, and as you'll hear, that's how he got into this story. Who these men were and how they ended up with John Brown drove Gene Meyer to write a book about them. John Brown wanted more freed blacks or born free blacks to join his army.
Well, he was hopeful that enslaved African-Americans would join his raid once he seized the arsenal and the armory at Harper's Ferry. They would go into the mountains of Virginia and kind of wage a guerrilla war. He was very tight with his plans. He didn't really give the details to his men until just before the raid. And they were under the impression, they were just going to run off slaves to Canada. They thought they were going to go north, not south. Brown was hopeful there would be more African Americans joining him, and he made a fateful decision when he heard that there were some rumors about the countryside about his attempt. So he moved the date up a week, and supposedly there were a number of African American slaves who were ready to join him, but because he moved the date up a week, they were not prepared. They just didn't know it was that the date had changed. Brown had hoped to enlist a prominent African-American, notably Frederick Douglass. Frederick Douglass lived in Rochester, And with him was Shields Green. Shields Green was an escaped slave from Charleston, South Carolina. He was born in 1836. He left after his wife had died. He had a six-month-old son. He had a slave name was Esau Brown. So I did as much research as I could. I looked at the Charleston Mercury newspaper for fugitive slave ads, hoping that Esau Brown would show up, a description of him. Couldn't find anything. Then I looked around for large slave owners named Brown, and I did find an individual who owned 150 slaves. And I looked at the census records, the slave census records for 1850 and 1860. In 1850, there was a male slave, they didn't give the names, who would have been the age of Shields Green. And in 1860, that particular individual was no longer on the roster. But there was a child, a one-year-old male slave. So I speculated, and I only do this in an endnote because I only write what I know, and if it's speculation, I say that. So I speculate that that was his son. Shields Green got on a ship in Charleston Harbor, probably a cotton ship, somehow found his way to Rochester, New York, lived with Frederick Douglass there for a time, even had a business card. He was a clothes cleaner. And there he met John Brown and learned a little bit about his plans. So when Brown was seeking to enlist Douglass, he wanted to have a meeting in Chambersburg, Pennsylvania, outside an abandoned quarry. So Douglass brought Shields Green with him, and they met over a weekend in August 1859. It started on a Saturday and went well into Sunday. And they talked about the plans. And John Brown said, you know, when this takes place, the bees will swarm, referring to the African-American slaves that would join him, and I need you to hive them. And Douglass wisely said, this plan isn't going to work. He said, you are walking into a perfect steel trap from which you will never emerge alive. And as they turned to leave, to go back to Rochester, he turned to Shields Green and said, you know, what do you want to do? And Shields Green said, I think I'll go with the old man. And go with him he did, to Harper's Ferry, and ultimately to the gallows.
Dangerfield Newby.
The Dangerfield Newby was from Culpeper, part of Piedmont, Virginia. And he was the son of a white man, Henry Newby, and Henry Newby's enslaved wife, who was owned by somebody else named John Fox. Our history is very complicated. And Henry Newby and Elsie had 11 children, of whom Dangerfield was the oldest. And there came a time when Henry Newby wanted to free his family. There were two ways he could do this. He could purchase them, or with the permission of John Fox, he could take them to Ohio, where once they set foot on the Ohio shores of the river, they would be free. And with John Fox's consent, he did just that in 1858. And Dangerfield Newby was one of those who moved with the rest of the family to Belmont, Ohio, Belmont County, right across the river from Wheeling. And he was a blacksmith by trade. He had also established an enduring union with a woman named Harriet, who was also an enslaved woman. They had as many as several children. She belonged to a Dr. Jennings in Brentsville. And there came a time when Dr. Jennings had fallen on financial hard times and planned to sell her and the children south, which is the worst thing that could happen because of the life of a slave in the plantation south Louisiana was much harsher. So Dangerfield was going around Ohio trying to raise money to purchase them. He had negotiated with Dr. Jennings, and he actually made three deposits into the Bank of Ohio in Belmont, totaling $742, which would be the equivalent today of about $21,000. And then either Dr. Jennings increased his price and wanted $1,000, which would have been $28,000, or for whatever reason, the deal fell through. And so Dangerfield joined with John Brown for very personal reasons. He met John Brown in northeastern Ohio. Brown was trying to recruit African Americans, and he was a little suspicious of Newby's motives. And he said, you know, I'm not here to purchase men. And Newby wasn't there to be purchased. He wanted to liberate Harriet and their children. During the spring and summer of 1859, she wrote three increasingly desperate letters to Dangerfield saying, you are my one bright hope, and master is going to sell me, I know not when, and please, Dangerfield, come soon, money or no money. If master sells me, all my hopes are blasted for the future, and you are my one bright hope. So it was quite an emotional and desperate situation for Dangerfield and Harriet, who ultimately was sold south with their children. Dangerfield died on the streets of Harper's Ferry on the second day of the raid, October 17th. He was shot from an upper floor of a building in the lower town. The shooter had run out of bullets. He used a six-inch spike that cut across Newby's neck. And it was a painful death. As he was dying or dead, some of the townspeople approached him and cut off his ears for souvenirs. And then they left him for the hogs. And the hogs rooted around in his body for a while. And then the townspeople dragged him to a short little street. And there's a street in Harper's Ferry called Hog Alley. So if you go there today, you'll know the origin of that name. Newby lay in the street for a day and a half. And ultimately, with several of the other raiders, was buried in a shallow grave half a mile up the Shenandoah River.
In John Brown's time, and the time of the Underground Railroad, Oberlin, Ohio, 35 miles southwest of Cleveland, was a safe haven for escaped slaves. Oberlin had been the site of an anti-slavery rebellion in 1858, and it was a destination for the families of two of the five African-American men who eventually joined John Brown at the Kennedy farmhouse, a saddlemaker named Lewis Leary, and a carpenter and anti-slavery activist named John Anthony Copeland.
John Anthony Copeland family was from Raleigh, North Carolina. They had emigrated north in the 1840s, and what motivated their move, they were free people of color. His father was a carpenter. The Nat Turner Rebellion in 1831 panicked a lot of the southern states, and they passed all these restrictive laws that even affected free people of color. So it was clearly not a place that, even if you were a free person of color, you wanted to be. So they migrated north to Ohio. And they went to Oberlin, which had been founded by New England Baptists. And Oberlin was an unusual place, even in the north. It was a place where black and white people went to church together. They went to schools together. They walked down the street hand in hand. So it was a natural destination. And of course, John Copeland went with him, and he attended the Oberlin College Prep School, and another North Carolina family, the Leary family, and that family had also migrated north. And the family lore is that Lewis Leary was kind of a rakish young man, that he saw a slave owner whipping a slave, and he interceded and started whipping the slave owner, at which point his father said, "You better leave now." So he went up to Oberlin as well, and he and Copeland were related through marriage. They weren't directly related. And Leary had heard John Brown speak, and so he actually recruited John Copeland to go with him. And when they left to join Brown here at the farmhouse, Copeland told his family he was going to teach in another county in Ohio. And by then, Leary had married a graduate of Oberlin, and they had a young daughter. And he didn't tell them anything. He just left in the middle of the night. It wasn't until quite some time later, after Leary had been killed, had been fatally shot, trying to escape across the Shenandoah River, died 8 hours later, that his widow learned about why her husband was gone. John Anthony Copeland wrote letters to his family the day of his execution, December 16, 1859. He had been captured, tried, convicted, and executed ultimately. And the letters were heart-wrenching. And so when I read those letters, I had an epiphany, and that was that there was a story here, but it couldn't just be about Osborne Anderson. It had to be about all five.
Osborne Perry Anderson.
Osborne Perry Anderson was from Chester County, Pennsylvania. He was the sole survivor of the raid, and he wrote the only insider account. It was called The Voice from Harper's Ferry. It was published in 1861, and it's a slim volume. It's about 75 pages. He was a free man of color. And he had immigrated to Canada after the passage of the Fugitive Slave Act in 1850, along with tens of thousands of other free and enslaved African Americans. And he was at the Constitutional Convention that John Brown had in Chatham in 1858. He was actually secretary of the convention. And he was the only one of the 30 or 40 or so gentlemen who were at that convention who actually came to Harper's Ferry. So he was one of the five. And he was the only one to actually escape and survive. He lived to 1872. He died in Washington, D.C. of tuberculosis.
Did he serve time in prison?
No, he didn't. He escaped. And he was my way into this story, by the way. Back in 2000, a plaque was being dedicated in his memory at a cemetery outside FedEx Field. And I wrote a short story about it for the Washington Post and ran inside the metro section. And probably few people saw it, but it made a lasting impression on me. And I thought maybe there was more to it.
According to Gene Meyer's research, Osborne Anderson might not have been a member of John Brown's army had it not been for the drawing of lots among the principals of a Canadian newspaper where he worked. The newspaper felt obliged to send at least one recruit to join Brown. So Anderson left Canada by train on September 13, 1859, arrived at Chambersburg, and from there met John Brown, and they made their way to the Kennedy farmhouse. Anderson later wrote that he found there an earnest, fearless, determined company of men. There, as at Chatham, I saw the same evidence of strong and commanding intellect, high-toned morality, and inflexibility on purpose, and a profound and holy reverence for God. There was no milk-and-water sentimentality, no offense contempt for the Negro while working in his cause. The pulsations of each and every heart beat in harmony for the suffering and pleading slave. Still, having drawn the short straw, Anderson's presence in the Brown Army and the fact that he escaped death or capture at Harper's Ferry begs a question. Was he the least committed of the five?
I think that they were all committed. There was some controversy about him. He was sort of dismissed by historians, even those sympathetic to John Brown, because he left his post. According to his account, he only left when it became apparent that he could be of no assistance to Brown. And he and another raider, Albert Hazlett, who was white, left and found their way into the Catoctin Mountains in Maryland. And their destination was Pennsylvania. And there came a point in time when Hazlett had sore feet and was tired. And they split up. And Hazlett proceeded to Carlisle, where he was from. He was subsequently captured and brought back to Charlestown, West Virginia, and tried, convicted, hanged in March 1860. And Osborne Anderson made it to York, Pennsylvania, where he was acquainted with a man named William Goodrich, who was an important figure in the Underground Railroad, but he actually owned an actual railroad, and he put Osborne Anderson on a train to Philadelphia. He went to see his father. Father turned him away. Ultimately, he wound up back in Chatham, Ontario, where he was described as looking like a skeleton. And then he proceeded to raise money and write his book. One of the early John Brown historians, Oswald Garrison Villard, said even though he questioned his account, he said it was still miraculous that he escaped.
Before he was hanged at Charlestown, John Brown wrote these words, "I am now quite certain that the crimes of this guilty land will never be purged away, but with blood. I had, as I now think, vainly flattered myself that without very much bloodshed, it might be done." In less than 2 years, the country would be torn apart by civil war. Over the nearly 160 years since Brown marched out of the Kennedy farm to the ill-fated raid at Harper's Ferry, he's been seen as both murderer and martyr, traitor and zealot, demented dreamer, liberator, fomenter of war, and an inspirational father of the civil rights movement. As Gene Meyer points out, the nation's regard of John Brown changed mightily between the 100th anniversary of Harper's Ferry and the 150th.
The centennial in 1959 was on the cusp of the Civil War centennial and also on the cusp of the Civil Rights Revolution. And the powers that be, who are white, were very nervous. And John Brown was not to be commemorated in any way, shape, or form. They didn't want to offend the Southern committees. And the five gentlemen I write about weren't part of the script at all. And John Brown was treated as a traitor, treasonous individual. I looked at 150 black and white pictures of Park Service had taken. There wasn't one person of color. And they reenacted the capture of John Brown, Civil War reenactors. The one he was, quote, recaptured, the crowd just went wild with, applause and shouting and cheering. They thought that was great. 2009, the country had changed, the first African-American president, the Park Service had changed, and there was much more of an effort made to make the event inclusive, including searching for descendants. So when I started working on this project, and I also write about what happened afterwards and the descendants and their legacies, the Park Service was able to provide me with a list of descendants, and I was able to contact several of them.
Based on what you told me about the commemorations of 1959 and how it compared to 2009, that the five were overlooked, or were all of the men overlooked? I mean, there is a certain amount of ambivalence about what John Brown did.
There may still be. I mean, I get when I go around and give talks, I have people ask me, don't you think what John Brown did was treasonous, you know, and that he violated the Constitution? And I say, well, you know, the foundational document of the Constitution counts African Americans as not even a full person. It was the original foundational document, certainly contrary to the ideals expressed in the Declaration of Independence.
In Five for Freedom, Gene Meyer tells the John Brown story, but the book is really about the African-American men who fought and died with him, and the one who lived to tell the tale, in the cause of ending slavery. They've been largely overlooked, lost in the tall and long shadow of their leader.
In many accounts, these five gentlemen are mentioned as an aside, if at all. There were also five black men with John Brown at Harper's Ferry, but their stories are never really told. And I think that the others in the party who were not African-American did receive more attention. I first visited Harper's Ferry long ago and far away. And I'd visited Harper's Ferry over the years, and it wasn't until really 2000 when I wrote the story about Osborne Perry Anderson, that plaque in the cemetery, that I became aware of him and the other four specifically. I'm just very excited and proud to be able to tell their story.
Eugene Meyer is an award-winning journalist, a longtime reporter and editor at the Washington Post. He's written for the New York Times and other publications as well. He lives in Silver Spring. Five for Freedom, his third book, is about the five African-American men who took part in John Brown's raid at Harper's Ferry in 1859, their roots and their descendants. Gene Meyer is scheduled to speak at the Enoch Pratt Free Library in Baltimore on Thursday, September 20th at 6:30 p.m. More information about that event and about the John Brown Farmhouse in Washington County can be found in the notes with this episode of Roughly Speaking. I'm Dan Rodericks at the Baltimore Sun. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you again soon.